You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Michael Lesher, a writer, journalist, attorney, a true gentleman and a scholar, and one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Dave. I can't very well quarrel with that introduction, except that I would certainly seem ill-tempered if I did, except the question whether I really am a scholar, something I never thought of being.
Well, I read your book, and I can say for sure that you are, and it really is a pleasure reading your writing because it's so specific and so detailed and so pleasant to read, and as well as speaking with you. So I can vouch for that, Michael.
Well, that I'm glad to hear. I know the subject matter of the book is not pleasant, but I actually do want people, when reading it, not to be put off by the writing. I hope that I've managed to convey some of this in a way that will keep people going and feel about it the way I feel about it when I hear these stories, which is to be more or less on the edge of your seat, just wanting to do something about it.
Yeah, I think so. I think you definitely did that in the book. Now, I want to get into your latest book, which is Sexual Abuse, Shonda, and Concealment in Orthodox Jewish Communities. But before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are and also how it is that you got into writing on this topic?
I am an Orthodox Jew, and I am, I confess, a lawyer as well as a writer. That is to say, I am admitted to the New York Bar, and I do some legal work. I do actually quite a bit of written work for litigation. So for me, from every direction, I had a real stake in an issue that involves the legal process and the Orthodox Jewish community. And the two of them overlap in a very tragic way when it comes to the abuse of children. I was not born into the Orthodox community, so it was something that I didn't originally know that I would be seeing when I became Orthodox. But as I began to see more and more of it, partly because of the legal work I was doing on behalf of victims of abuse from other communities, I also began to see that there was a great deal the Orthodox Jewish community was not doing to try to help the victims of child sexual abuse or to prevent the problem from spreading or persisting. And then, in fact, the community did a great deal to try to cover up instances of abuse when they did occur. And so I became engaged with that, and at first I did a lot of work in individual cases for people who had been victims of child sexual abuse, trying to get their stories into print, in some cases actually taking a legal approach and trying to get those cases back into the justice system where they belonged. And this has been going on for years now. It's a little bit stunning when I look back and realize that I actually started writing about this, well, I started working on it in 1995 and had the first pieces published on the subject in 1996. I hate to think that's 20 years ago.
Yeah, I know.
So, yeah, that has now become a large part of my life, and quite an unexpected part. But it culminated in the writing of this book where, with considerable unpleasantness but also considerable determination, I decided to try to put into one place between covers what I think I know or believe I know about this subject as a whole, focusing not so much on the fact that children do get sexually abused in the Orthodox Jewish community. I don't think that should come as a terrible shock to anybody. Children get abused in every community. But focusing rather on the way the community handles these issues, the way it covers up the cases. And that's what I tried to get in the title, which was actually the publisher's choice, but it was originally to be Sexual Abuse and Concealment in Orthodox Jewish Communities. I wanted the word Shonda in the title because that is, in fact, the word that in these communities gets used a great deal to describe them. Shonda is a shame in Yiddish, and it has a double meaning. It means something that's kind of scandalous and shameful, and we don't want to talk about it or think about it or let anybody else know about it because it's shameful. And it also describes something that really is shameful, which, in my view, is what we have to call the phenomenon that I wrote about, which is that these issues are covered up in the Orthodox Jewish community. Victims are silenced and, in fact, sometimes stigmatized for coming forward and trying to do something about the fact that they have been abused by other members of the community.
Hmm. And it's not just about child abuse in this community, but it's also about the interesting relationship that this community has, or the leaders of this community, that they have with the secular U.S. political system.
Yes, and that's a very important aspect of the book. And I alluded to it a bit when I said that I made contact with this issue, not just because I'm an Orthodox Jew, but also because I'm a lawyer. It is a remarkable part of the story, I think, how much the cover-up mechanisms involve, I suppose the word would be a sort of overlap or interface between Orthodox Jewish institutions and the institutions of the secular justice system, also the secular news media to a large extent, but certainly the secular justice system in communities where Orthodox Jews make up a significant part of the population. Obviously, there's no magic to this. It's not as though rabbis can recite a formula and make the courts do what they want them to do. but in areas where they constitute a significant part of the community and have considerable political influence, that political influence has been invested in making both the child welfare system and the courts treat the issue largely the way the Orthodox leadership does. Let me just give one very graphic example which comes out of the book, and many people here I think would find quite shocking if they knew about it, and that's part of the problem is they don't know about it. Let me put it this way. Not long ago, just maybe a month or so, the New York Times ran a piece about a mullah in Afghanistan who was convicted of raping a 10-year-old girl in his mosque in Kunduz. He was convicted in a secular court and got a hefty sentence. And the gist of the story was that prosecutions like this are rare, the community discourages them, the religious leaders don't like it. In this case, he actually blamed the girl. He said that she had seduced him, that victims are often blamed for these things, and so on. All of this was very familiar to me, except that this was happening thousands of miles away and was in Afghanistan. What was not reported in the New York Times then or any time before or since, what has not been reported in any New York newspaper, was the case of Israel Weingarten, a Hasidic rabbi in New York, who did much the same thing. He was ultimately convicted in a federal court of repeatedly raping his own daughter over a period of years, starting when she was 10 years old. But you never read in any New York newspaper that his crimes were reported to state authorities years before the prosecution ever took place in a federal court. Child welfare officials looked the other way. A panel of rabbis to whom the couple went when the parents were divorcing actually awarded full custody of all six of the minor children to Rabbi Weingarten, who was raping one of them. And that decision was then rubber-stamped by a Rockland County Family Court judge. So here again, the secular justice system got directly involved, as did the child welfare system, and the way they got involved was to cover up the crime. 7 years go by, eventually the girl grows up and locates federal prosecutors who are willing to take her case. And so she's able to get him prosecuted in federal court because he took her out of the country and back as part of his cycle of abuse. But the point I'm making is that this culture of cover-up that involved a religious figure, a religious community, and in fact, in his case, brought members of the religious community into his prosecution to malign the victim, to say she was a liar and she was promiscuous and she was all sorts of things. Remember, she started getting raped when she was 10, just like the girl in Afghanistan.
Right.
None of that was reported in the local press, even though it's happening here in a religious community that people here know very well. And it also wasn't reported that the secular justice system had likewise been, let's say, sidelined in a way that in Afghanistan we were told about. Victims are discouraged from going to it. The community doesn't like it when they intervene. Okay, all true there. I'm glad they reported that. But that's a long way away. The same story happens here, and it doesn't get talked about.
Why is it?
Well, there are a lot of reasons why, but you have to begin with the fact that we tend not to want to see things that affect us more directly. I think it's much easier for people to read stories about things like this unfolding in a faraway place like Afghanistan among religious people who seem quite strange to us than it is to realize we have to face the realities of these kinds of things unfolding right before us among people we know. And that's particularly vivid when I think about myself, because I'm a member of this religious community. And it is not pleasant for me to realize this is happening. But unless we do realize it and acknowledge it and publicly confront it, it's just going to go on.
But it doesn't seem like it bothers too many people in that community.
Well, that is changing. There are plenty of people who are bothered by it. You can go online these days and look up some blogs like From Follies or Failed Messiah or Unorthodox Jew and see plenty of angry comments coming from people inside the community about the way sex abuse and other things too, but in particular sex abuse is being handled within the community. But these are people who are relatively marginalized. Now, the leadership, and I do talk about this in the book, the leadership is starting to be prodded out of complete silence. It is acknowledging that there is a problem. It is acknowledging that in the past, as they like to say, in the past, these issues have been ignored. Many of the major rabbinic organizations in the United States have made public pronouncements to the effect that we understand there was a problem and things are changing. But I also argue in the book that if you look closely at what they're really doing and match their actions against their words, it's really less true to say that they've recognized the error of their ways than to say they've found new forms of denial. And I'm afraid that's generally the case throughout the Orthodox community. I don't know if you saw this, but recently there were quite a few remarkable stories coming out of Australia.
Yes.
A community I don't know as well. But in Australia, there was actually a government commission that investigated allegations of sex abuse cover-ups at a prominent Orthodox institution in Australia. And we saw the same thing. And the worst of it was that some of the rabbis who testified actually made comments essentially either defending the fact that they had covered it up or minimizing the offense. One said, well, I didn't know you weren't supposed to do this. The picture is quite remarkable because even though these organizations have said publicly, we recognize child sex abuse as a serious crime and we don't want to let it go. What really happens when the charge is pitted against a prominent institution is that all sorts of dynamics of denial come into play that make it very difficult for the victims to fight against it. So that even though the leaders may not be saying, we're silencing you because we don't believe in justice for sex abuse victims, that's in the end what it comes down to.
Yeah, one part of the book, which I guess I was kind of shocked at, maybe I shouldn't be, on page 58, where you're describing this fella, I think it was Hafner, is that right? When he got off the hook, I guess?
Yes.
And here, right at the top of page 58, where you say that this huge synagogue that served as a central place of worship for a certain sect of Hasidim, and where on the holiday of Purim, when the rabbi's victory over the justice system, of course that's the secular justice system, was announced, some 3,000 pious Jews broke out in song to mock the alleged victim's family.
That's right. I'll tell you one remarkable background thing about that story is that we didn't hear that from the angry victim's family. We heard that from one of the rabbis on the rabbinic court that cleared Hafner. He was telling us this to show how the whole community really got together to support this unfairly accused man. He was quite happy that that happened. Again, I think that helps to illustrate the kinds of priorities and perspective that are brought to bear here. Now, I have to say, to be completely fair, Rabbi Hafner was never convicted of anything. The charges were dropped. So I refer to these incidents as alleged incidents. But remember, this was a very serious criminal complaint listing, I think, 96 counts. It was very credible. It was backed by a very respected, well-credentialed child abuse expert. And it never even got to the grand jury. Grand jury proceedings started, but was then stopped when the prosecutors withdrew the case. When I interviewed them, they couldn't or wouldn't give me a reason why the evidence against Hafner was not sufficient to go to trial. They kept telling me it wasn't. They kept telling me they had received, I think the word they used was overwhelming evidence of his innocence. I don't think I'm an idiot, and I tried every avenue I could. I talked to the police detective that pursued the case. I talked to the child abuse expert. I spoke to the victim's family. I asked the prosecutors to share with me anything that they could to show me why the case wasn't viable. As you see in the book, I couldn't find anything. My co-writer and I found nothing other than the fact that the rabbis didn't want the case pursued. And that's really what the celebration in the end was about. To put it another way, as someone else has said regarding another case, I wasn't directly involved. She knew of a young person who was expelled from an Orthodox school because she had reported being sexually abused, I think, by one of the rabbis there. And it was a teacher. When kids asked what happened, the way the administrators answered it, she said, was not to say that the child was lying or that nobody had done anything wrong to her, but she had done the wrong thing. She had not obeyed the rabbis because she had gone to the police.
Right. And it's encouraged in that community to handle matters outside of the secular authorities when the law has been broken.
That's right. And so in this case, too, you have the victim of Rabbi Hafner who becomes automatically a bad person. To some extent, as I describe in the book, almost a non-person. Or the way I describe it in the book is that you become automatically an outsider to the community. And as an outsider, you're automatically a threat.
Right. Is it mostly because of block voting, Michael, that they seem to get their way with the secular authorities?
Well, I think that's obviously a factor. Because the community will tend to vote as a whole, one way or another, that can certainly make them influential. There is no shortage of, from those who have it, there's no shortage of political contributions also. To some extent, I think there may also just be a sort of intersection of interests. It's a lot easier from the point of view of many people in the secular justice system, because I deal with these cases both in and out of the Orthodox community. I can tell you, lots of people don't want to see these cases prosecuted, especially when the alleged perpetrator is a family member of the victim, a respected teacher, a clergyman. So if they have an excuse for just turning these issues loose and letting them be governed by something, or they may choose to believe it's being governed by authorities inside the community, I think in many cases they're probably kind of happy to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, these communities, of course, as you've detailed throughout the book, are very insular, and they don't have much contact, I guess, with non-Orthodox folk, whether they be Jewish or non-Jewish. Why is it, Michael, that you decided to, I guess you were what were you before you became an Orthodox Jew? Did you have a title? Were you like a conservative Jew or liberal?
No, I didn't have a title. I really wasn't a believer at all. So I didn't consider myself any sort of Jew. I wasn't involved with the Jewish community in any way. and I became involved with the Orthodox community as part of the process of educating myself, trying to learn more about being Jewish and where I came from. And I ultimately decided the only way I'm really going to understand this is to become part of it.
Okay.
And I was willing to think, well, okay, if I try it and it turns out to be a big bust, I can abandon it, but otherwise I'll pursue it and see where it takes me. It's a long story, but that's essentially what
mm-hmm.
I did.
Do you think you made the right decision?
I think I made the right decision. You know, it's always difficult to go back 30 years or whatever it is in one's life and second-guess decisions that you made, knowing a whole lot less about where you're going to be than one knows now. But I do think that not only was it a reasonable decision based on what I knew at the time, I think it's a decision that I don't regret, even knowing everything that I know now. I think I would do it over again. I would see it a bit differently. I might follow a somewhat different path, but I think I would still do it.
The reason I'm asking is because I would imagine you're not very much loved in that community. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. First of all, I don't want to exaggerate. This is important to me because there are people who face real danger, real threats for coming forward on issues like this. And I describe them in the book. A rabbi who lives in a Hasidic community who has been a very outspoken advocate for victims, who was excommunicated from his community and a couple of times was physically attacked. At one point, somebody threw bleach in his face, which could have blinded him. Fortunately,
right.
He was able to wash it out. But that did happen. And there are victims who have lost their jobs, had to move. The victim family of the alleged victim of Solomon Hofner had to move out of the community where they lived and relocate somewhere else. And that happened again recently in the case of Rabbi Yosef Kolko, which I describe in the book as well. Now, he actually did end up pleading guilty, so we don't have to say alleged. We know he was abusing the kid.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the child he abused and his father, who was a respected rabbi, had to leave the religious community where they were living and move elsewhere. I don't face that kind of threat. I don't want to be bracketed with any of that. I've never faced or experienced any such repercussions in the community where I live. There are people who are not happy about the fact that I'm doing it. There's also a lot of people who are very happy about it. I see both.
I was wondering if you had ever received any threats.
On occasion, have received some very angry mail or phone calls, sometimes for the oddest reasons. I can't remember a time when I got a furious email specifically because of what I wrote about abused children. But occasionally the issue will overlap into something else. For example, in the book I describe at some length the Jewish police forces that operate in many of the heavily Orthodox areas that are called Shomrim, which means guardians or guards, mm-hmm. patrols that the Orthodox community runs internally. So I did have a piece on that published in a New York tabloid. And there the theme of the irate emails and calls I got was basically, how dare you criticize Shomrim. Everything I had said, which was about 75% of the piece, about Shomrim's record in interfering in child abuse cases was completely ignored by the critics. Just their objection was that I said something bad about the Shomrim group, which in their view, we really need. They're protecting us. They're doing wonderful things.
Right. And they're perfect.
Right. They have to be perfect because they're Jews and they're protecting Jews. And this feeds back into this cultural complex, which is not unique to Orthodox Jews by any means, where the community tends to look at the outside world as relatively threatening and therefore to justify the kinds of measures we take to keep outsiders out and to keep us from going to outsiders as necessary means for protection. And once you begin to convince yourself of that, it's pretty easy to start shuffling around your moral priorities. I talk a little bit about things like this in the book. Anybody who looks at some of the measures that have been invoked in the United States to counter what is called terrorism, which is really, by any objective standard, quite a small threat to Americans living here,
right,
can see a similar pattern. Once you start to get people scared and invoke their fears, they'll put up with an awful lot that objectively, really, no one should take.
Right, and I guess the main reason that this can happen in those communities, in those Orthodox Jewish communities, is because of the power that the rabbis have over their flocks.
That is a very important factor, and it's something that I talk about in the book. Now, again, this varies a little bit from place to place and community to community, and one has to take that into consideration. I don't live in a Hasidic community. I don't live in a very right-wing Orthodox world where we speak Yiddish and nobody talks to outsiders. I live in a much more modern community where the population is much more mixed between Jews and non-Jews, so there's a certainly different communal attitude about the way certain things are handled. On the other hand, as I point out in the book, even in what are called the most modern Orthodox parts of the community, you still see similar patterns in how sex abuse cases are handled or not handled when a rabbi is accused, for example. Because a rabbi still, in whatever religious community you're in, whatever version of Orthodoxy it is still a figure of very great authority, very high up on the hierarchical chain. And to challenge him, to have a child challenge him in a very graphic and intimate sort of way by saying this person is a sexual criminal is something that's very disturbing to communities generally, regardless of what community that kind of charge arises in. I will say that on the more modern wing of the spectrum, there are far more people who will do what I would do, who would immediately go to the police, and others who will defend people for doing that. You're a lot better off in such a community if you've done that than if you live among the bubble of Hasidim the way the alleged victim of Rabbi Hafner did. On the other hand, as I describe in the book, you have a very popular, influential, respected rabbi like Mordechai Alon, who, when he's accused of sex abuse, again, is able to resort to the good old cover-up and slander the victim's tactics, and was remarkably successful right up to the end, where he ends up entering a guilty plea, even within this relatively modern, enlightened Orthodox world. So I don't think the problems are just functions of the very insular and relatively, let's say, poorly educated, in secular terms, parts of the community. It has much more to do with the kinds of priorities that we invoke when our system gets challenged.
Do you think that this child abuse epidemic here in the Orthodox community is any different from child abuse epidemics in other non-Jewish, non-Orthodox communities?
Well, I can't really know that, but everything that I do know and everything I can find out makes me believe that there's no real difference in the kinds of problems that we have with abuse itself.
In the numbers, I mean, Michael.
I don't know. It's really, really hard to know that. But the best estimates that we have so far, that basically the numbers are consistent through communities. To the extent sex abuse is about a disorder, an unnatural sexual attraction to children, or to the extent it's about sort of psychological need people are satisfying when they abuse children, I don't think these things are particularly present in the Orthodox community as compared to others. I think it's pretty much a problem to be found throughout societies. But it will intensify, and the effects of it will intensify to the extent it is not addressed. And that's, to me, a real problem and a real danger. When I think of some of the people who have come to me, not just one or two, a fair number of people from particular communities, all of whom had suffered abuse, and in none of those cases had any legal intervention taken place, you start to ask yourself, what happens to all these other people when they grow up? What are the psychological effects going to be on them? Not just because they were abused, but because their abuse was ignored, covered up, they were blamed for it. What are they going to do as they grow up? And how is that going to affect the community? Now that I've been doing this, hard to believe, but I have been doing this for some 20 years, that's not an academic question. I'm talking to people now who were in their 30s and 40s who were victims when they were children.
Wow. I can't imagine, especially the way that they're ostracized for reporting something that happened to them by someone who's supposed to be almost like a godlike figure in their communities.
That's right. And then what do they tell their kids? And how does this lesson get passed on? And I worry about it. Whatever happens, the legacy of this cannot be a healthy one until we confront the problem in a healthy way. I don't suggest we can eliminate abuse. I don't see how you can do that without turning your whole community into an absolute police state, which I wouldn't want to do, obviously. There are people who are going to be victims of crime in one form or another. But if they can get justice, if the community as a whole can say to them and to the perpetrators and to each other, this is wrong, this is punishable, and the victim is innocent, then I have a lot of hope, knowing what I know about human resilience, that people can grow through it and heal. But if you cover it up, if you tell the victims they're at fault, if you tell the victims there is no justice for what happened to you, and you still have to go on honoring and admiring this rabbi and others like him, this is one of the things that people call me about. I just saw the guy get an honor in a synagogue, so they called me up in an outrage. This is the guy that abused me. So when you see that, when you live with that, then you have not just a personal wound, but a social wound that is not going to heal.
How is the book doing, Michael? I can't imagine such an important book is being sought after by the mainstream media for book reviews.
I'm hoping to get more attention. It took a while, but I did get a review in the Jewish Week, which is a major, not Orthodox, just general Jewish publication in the United States, and a very positive review. I was very pleased to see that and grateful to the reviewer for paying attention to it. But so far, I think there's been less attention paid to it than I, perhaps selfishly, think the book really deserves. The reason I think that, by the way, is not just that I wrote the book and would love to be seeing attention paid to it, copies sold, of course I would, but I'm also comparing what it seems to be the response to the book with the increasing discussion of the issue in mainstream media. There was, for example, a front page story in the New York Times not too long ago. I was interviewed for it, though I wasn't quoted in it, about how child sex abuse is starting to be recognized as a problem within the Orthodox Jewish communities. And I was interviewed and quoted in another story about one of the cases I describe in the book, the case of Avraham Mandru. It's a particularly outrageous case I've been very much involved in for a long time.
Right.
And this is not just one paper. Lots of newspapers showed an interest in this. Lots of papers have been writing about how this is a growing issue and the community is starting to deal with it and so on. So it would seem to me that the first book that analyzes it and that looks at how these cases have been handled and why they have been mishandled might be a topic of broader interest. I acknowledge that the average reader, what is happening to the children in Orthodox Jewish communities may seem a relatively marginal question. Sometimes I think that way too. I look at it in context of the world at large, and I ask myself, at a time when we might be literally looking at the extinction of human civilization, either from ecological disaster or from nuclear war, both of which we seem to be rushing toward as fast as we can, how big an issue is it that the institutions connected with one small religious community are covering up cases of child sex abuse? But then I say to myself, if we're going to have any hope of doing a better job in the next generation, and I'm getting old enough to think about this now, I'm 57,
right,
and have any more success than our generation had in averting these calamities, it's going to depend on our children. Our children are going to have to do a better job than we are, and to do that, they're going to have to grow up healthy. If they grow up in fear, if they grow up under a regime of violence, if they grow up knowing from their own personal experience that justice doesn't happen and that evil is not repaid with punishment but with more evil, are they going to be healthy enough and strong enough to have the humanity and the capacity to love in them to change the course that humanity is going in? I don't think so. Maybe this is an overblown way of looking at it, but it seems to me that whatever we can do to protect the children around us from some of the things that are ravaging them right now, that is our best hope for the future.
Sexual Abuse, Shonda, and Concealment in Orthodox Jewish Communities by Michael Lesher. Michael, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners. As always, it's a great pleasure and honor speaking with you, and thank you for doing what you're doing. It can't be easy.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And no, it hasn't been easy, but I'm not complaining. It's been a lot harder for the victims of these crimes, and I hope that what I've been able to invest in this will be of some help to building a better future.